December 9th, 1965 was especially mild in Pennsylvania. 40 years ago, a visitor came from another world.
We decided, my brother and a friend of his, to go coon hunting. And we were moving abreast through the woods above Meteor Road, above the Kalm Farm. I kind of looked back towards Kecksburg because this bright light caught my eye. I thought, my God, that's a plane. It's on fire. So I'm watching it, and all of a sudden, it changed course 90 degrees. And now, it's headed directly towards me. I saw it coming in, and I saw it come down. I had one of the dogs with me, and ran to the site, went down into the ravine, and a small brush fire had started down into the ravine, and I noticed this is not an airplane. I shined the light on it to see if there was any type of opening or anything, or any type of identifying mark, and there was a band. 1 foot up from the base, there was a band, a metal band. It looked like it had some type of drawings on it or some type of lettering. We had all three dogs with us, and the dogs had their hackles raised on their backs.
Welcome back to our Kecksburg special. I can't believe it's 40 years, but it is. Leslie Kane is on the line from New York City, one of my favorite journalists, and she has been reporting on quite a few things, including some new forensic evidence. Right, Leslie?
That's right. We've got some very exciting evidence on the Kecksburg case.
Yeah, I want to get into that in a minute with you. Because I know you're going to be there for the celebration.
Absolutely. I'll be there on December 10th, and we hope that any listeners who can make it will come as well.
Well, we have been plugging at that along here, so most people know where it's going to be there, and they know where Kecksburg is.
Kecksburg is a tiny little place, but they can find it. And anybody who needs directions can contact Stan Gordon for any information they might need about getting there. So,
now you have some video clips of John Podesta, the Clinton administration, talking about things, right?
I do indeed. I'm going to be showing some of those on at the event on December 10th.
Well, what is he saying?
Well, he came. He spoke with us at two press conferences. I can actually read you a little quote if you'd like.
Yeah, that would be good.
Really great. The first press conference was in October 2003, which was when we actually launched this Kecksburg initiative that was supported by the Sci-Fi Channel. And John Podesta came out with us in support of the effort. And here's a little quote. Here's one thing he said, which I think is a very eloquent and powerful statement. He said at that press conference, "I think it's time to open the books on questions that have remained in the dark on the question of government investigations of UFOs. It's time to find out what the truth really is that's out there. We ought to do it because it's right. We ought to do it because the American people, quite frankly, can handle the truth. And we ought to do it because it's the law."
And, you know, there were a lot of reports in the Clinton administration that they tried to get some reports out, and they never really were very successful, were they?
Apparently so. I don't know a lot about the U.S. Apparently Rockefeller was interested in trying to get some action under Clinton. But what's interesting about John Podesta is that he cares a great deal about freedom of information, which is so much what this Kecksburg case is about. And he was responsible for major reforms under President Clinton, which made information more available, more accessible to citizens under the Freedom of Information Act. And he got about 800 million pages of documents declassified under Clinton.
Wow.
So this is an issue that means a great deal to him, is the people's right to information. And
let's talk a little bit about your organization here, the CFI. Why don't you tell people what that is?
Well, CFI stands for the Coalition for Freedom of Information. And this was basically just a kind of a core group that was formed in the fall of 2003 when we decided to take on this Kecksburg case, which again was, the whole effort was initiated by the Sci-Fi Channel. And basically, the effort was spearheaded by myself as a journalist, but I've been working with a public relations firm called Podesta Mattoon, and also with Larry Landsman, who is the director of special projects from the Sci-Fi Channel. The three of us were sort of the core people which called ourselves the Coalition for Freedom of Information. But we'd also been working with a Washington law firm who have done all the legal work for us on the initiative, which definitely requires a lawyer, unfortunately. And we had also, as part of our team, of course, we worked with Stan Gordon, who has been the investigator on the ground for 40 years in Ketchburg, as well as a private investigator who was formerly with the General Accounting Office, and a History Associates, which is an archival research firm. So it was a really highly skilled, highly professional team, and we formed this group called the Coalition for Freedom of Information, or CFI.
Well, now, I know you've come up with some pretty startling information here. Ruling out the idea that it was a Russian satellite, right?
That seems to be the case. I mean, my job as a journalist is to do interviews and provide information, and I've received information from experts, from leading experts in the world on the Cosmos 96 question, which is the question of whether this object could have been a Russian satellite. That satisfies my criteria as a journalist for determining that it could not have been, which basically means that I believe the reports that I've received from high-level people, one of whom is at NASA. I don't know how much detail you want me to provide about it, but who was really able to determine without a doubt by looking at the coordinates of any objects that would have been in the sky that day. He was able to tell us that it could not have been a Russian satellite. And based on my extensive interviews with him, I have no reason to doubt what he's saying. So
yeah, I understand that.
People can choose to disbelieve him if they want, but I happen to not be of that persuasion. So he gave.
Now you had an article out recently. Tell our audience a little bit about that.
Well, it was an article for the journal IUR, which stands for the International UFO Reporter, and it's really because of the 40th anniversary, I wrote a long piece that kind of summarizes where we are to date in some detail on the case. It's really a very focused update and summary of all the work we've done. So if anybody wants to read that article, it is on our website, which is the CFI website. I'm sure you have links there on your site.
Yes, we do, and
expect people to go on to your site and make that connection, I hope.
Yeah, and basically, 40 years later, what have you found out that's new?
Well, and just to give you a little more on this question of, the Cosmos 96, which was a Russian space capsule that re-entered the atmosphere early in the morning of the same day of the Ketchburg event, and the Ketchburg event took place in the evening. And many people over the years have been under the belief that this was probably what it was that came down in Ketchburg, even though we know from U.S. Space Command that this thing, disintegrated in the sky over Canada. Nonetheless, it's been an argument that people have used. So one of the most startling bits of information that we've got recently is based on my interviews with Nicholas Johnson, who's the chief scientist for orbital debris at the NASA Johnson Space Center, internationally renowned authority on orbital debris and foreign space systems, and has written books, testified before Congress. His resume is extremely impressive. And one of the books he wrote was talks about specifically on Soviet lunar space programs, et cetera, and space programs that would relate to the question we have, that we're asking here. And in a nutshell, he was able to acquire the orbital data, which there's only one Russian space capsule that could have possibly been the one, because that's the only one that was in the sky, and that's this Cosmos 96 that I mentioned. He was able to obtain the orbital data for Cosmos 96, which showed exactly where it was in the sky, and determine if it had been in the sky, and if it had still been in orbit at the time of the Ketchburg event, could it have landed in Pennsylvania? It's a very simple thing to do. And by looking at the data, he was able to determine it could not possibly have been in Pennsylvania. If it had been orbiting that day, it would have come over the eastern part of the United States at 6:20 a.m., but wouldn't have been anywhere near Pennsylvania at 5:45, which is when the object came down there. Absolutely eliminate that possibility.
Yeah, the so that's basically in the time 5:45, it was already dark.
It was just getting dark. That's correct. Yeah, and it was, you know, we know the object, the Cosmos 96, came down over Canada at six, at very early in the morning. I think it was 3 a.m. or something.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did Nicholas Johnson determine for me that therefore this object could not have been Cosmos 96, but he also stated that by looking at lots of other records and computer records, and, you know, he has access to all the information, he made the statement that there was no man-made object that could have come down on that day at that time, anything in space, because he says that he has records for these things. He said no man-made object from any country came down on December 9th, 1965.
Well, that's pretty definitive.
Pretty definitive, given who this man is.
Yeah, yes. Now you have done quite a lot of investigation, talking to eyewitnesses and things like that. I know we did a show several years ago about this. And what's your overall impression? You know, some of the witnesses are dying out now, unfortunately, but there's still some people that remember it.
There's a lot of witnesses, actually, which is one of the reasons why our group took this case on, because there were so many living witnesses, and there still are. Some of them are in poor health, though, some of the key ones. But my experiences with them has been that they are sincere, you know, genuine people. Many of them have never been out of this small area, this small town or nearby town in their whole lives. You know, they have no vested interest in making up stories. The ones who have gone public have received nothing but grief for their testimony, which is often the case when people talk about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have, you know, I have not found any problems with the witnesses. I find them very believable and sincere. And the interesting thing is that each witness has sort of a little piece of the puzzle. You know, they had one particular experience, or they observed one particular aspect of the event that night. And when you put them all together, which is what Stan Gordon has been spending decades doing, that's when you get a very clear picture of what went on. And there are not contradictions between these witnesses. The stories add up, they confirm each other, and they all make sense in terms of the timeline and the events. So the numbers of witnesses we have make the case extremely compelling.
Leslie, have we ever figured out what the government did with this capsule?
Well, no. I mean, we've had some suggestions that it may have ended up at Wright-Patterson, and, you know, but that's, again, an area we know very little about, is where it went and what happened. There have been a couple of reports that have gone to Stan.
Yeah, we discussed some of that. I was thinking maybe you had uncovered something on a more official scale.
No, unfortunately not. I would like to, though, but that's, you know, that's the problem we've been facing, is, you know, getting something on an official scale has been extremely difficult about anything, any aspect of this case, let alone an admission of where it might be, because the government's denying that it ever took place at all.
In the interview we just did with Stan before you came on, we talked about the reports of NASA personnel being there. Have you ever been able to confirm that?
Well, not that we have not been able to confirm. I mean, you know, that's a tricky question. We haven't been able to confirm. No, your question is that they were there. No, we have not.
Mm-hmm.
To confirm that. An individual whose name we had, you know, worked for NASA and would very likely have been there, given all that we know about this individual and given what we know about his position at NASA, and what we know some witnesses told Stan as to what they remembered the person's name being. You know, there's a lot of things pointing to that, to this person being present, and witnesses who observed NASA.
Is this person still around?
No, unfortunately, this man, whose name is Richard Schulher, is deceased, and his family has also not been willing to speak with us. But we've been able to learn a lot about him through our efforts, but nothing definitive that he was actually there.
Well, it sounds like maybe his job was investigating special circumstances or something?
Yeah, his one job was, he worked for Project Moondust, which was, you know, as many of your listeners probably know, an Air Force project that involved the retrieval of objects from space, including unidentified flying objects. And we have some documentation that shows that he was, in, you know, a NASA, an officer with Project Moondust. These are the people that would have been called out on the scene when something from the sky came down. So we know that he was at the time of the event with Moondust. He was also a curator for some files called the Fregology files, which we've been trying to obtain from NASA.
I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, not many people have, but they're files that sort of describe the collections of objects that have been retrieved from various locations and where they were retrieved. They're records of objects that have been retrieved.
Have you been able to see any of those files?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. We know that these files existed, but we were told by NASA, as was Stan Gordon prior to our investigation, that all these files have been missing since 1987. Now, the funny thing about that is Stan Gordon actually received a list of the names of these files years prior to our investigation, and there was a handwritten notation on that list stating that the files were at the Federal Records Center in 1994.
Even though they were supposed to be missing in 1987.
Exactly. Now, then when we received a copy of the list, the same one that Gordon received, that notation had been whited out. And they told us that these have been missing since 1987. So this is the kind of thing you come up against.
Yeah,
sort of at a dead end. There's nothing more you can do except file a lawsuit, which we did. It's possible they have been missing since 1987. It's possible that that notation on Gordon's document that said 1994 was some kind of a mistake. I mean, that's conceivable. But you're left sort of hanging without really knowing what to do when you get information like that.
Hold on, Leslie. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. I want to talk a little bit more about Kecksburg and find out what else is on your platter. You're always a busy woman. Now, don't go away, folks.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown. Every month in Fate Magazine.
Fate Magazine has actually been published continuously since 1948. That makes it the longest-running publication of its kind. From psychics and spiritualists, archaeological hotspots and fringe science, to authoritative UFO and paranormal investigations, Fate articles are factual, informative, and entertaining. Subscribe to Fate Magazine today. Simply go to FateMag.com, FateMag.com, or check it out at your local newsstand. Fate Magazine is a favorite for people looking for answers and for people looking for entertainment.
Fate.
Tales of the Strange and the Unknown.
Jerry Piven.
On the line from New York City, we have Leslie Kane. We're talking about Kecksburg. You'll be there on December 10th. I think the thing starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Correct. 1 o'clock in the afternoon at the Kecksburg Fire Hall, which is a very important location for this case because that's where the military kind of took over that facility the night of the event.
You know, originally, I guess, the volunteer fire department went out there and...
Exactly. Some members of it did, and one in particular who's still with us today, James Romanski, a very crucial witness in the case, was one of the first on the scene, actually, and was able to give a detailed description of the object as well as show Stan Gordon the location of the object. So firefighters have been very important, and they actually have a model outside the fire hall of the object up on a platform.
Yeah, I understand they're going to renovate that thing and have their own little festival.
Exactly. Well, they're playing a major role in our event on the 10th.
Mm-hmm.
Renovated it. They've put some kind of protective covering over it, cleaned it up, and they're going to be selling T-shirts to commemorate this event and providing refreshments and playing a major role, and we're very grateful to them for that.
So what else are you working on, Leslie?
Well, other than the Cosmos 96 question, which I think is sort of settled, another very interesting aspect of this case has been the physical evidence that was discovered on the site. And this was not, of course, my work. This was some scientists that we brought down to the site, which actually part of the Sci-Fi Channel documentary, which is where the information was first released. But we had an archaeologist and a forestry professor from West Virginia University come down, do some extensive work, and what's the most interesting element of that was that the forestry expert, was able to document physical damage to trees at the location. And even more interesting was he was able to document the date in which the injuries to these trees occurred by looking at the rings. And you can date, you know, you can go back through time with a tree.
Yeah, I remember that from high school biology.
So he was able to determine, and these were trees, by the way, that had been photographed in the early 80s by Stan Gordon. As you know, you can see the damage visually. And he was told by a witness, John Hayes, that these were the trees that were damaged at the time, because this witness had been there the day after and had seen these damaged trees. And the visual effects don't go away when you have a huge trunk that's broken off or you have branches.
Mm-hmm.
So he looked at these, and he was able to match these trees to the photograph, so he knew we were in the right place. And when he looked at the tree rings to see when the damage occurred, it occurred in 1965. That's something that you can discover by looking at trees. You know, it's fairly straightforward. Just like Nicholas Johnson, what you have to do is look at the data, and that's what these people have done. It's not speculation. And so he, by being able to date the actual damage to the trees and determine that this was not caused by weather or something else or disease, because the trees around it were fine, you can see a trajectory line where something came and damaged trees. And, this was not caused by some natural event. It was some physical object that broke these trees.
Yeah, I understand. Your report with the NASA experts on the Russian satellite, eliminating that, really kind of nails this, that this was something, I guess, from outer space.
Well, maybe so. I mean, his opinion was that it could not have been anything man-made. I don't know where that leaves us in terms of options.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't willing to go any further than that, Nicholas Johnson, to speculate what it was. You know, and he said there's always a remote possibility that it could have been something that he's not aware of, but he says the chances of that, he in quotes, are virtually nil, those
mm-hmm.
are his words, as to whether this could have been some secret thing that, you know, somehow slipped through and he didn't know about. He says, you know, we were monitoring things in the sky at that time very, very carefully. Everything that comes in gets recorded. A huge thing can't come through our atmosphere without somebody knowing about it.
Yeah, especially back in those days of the Cold War.
Exactly. And the Soviets were monitoring things as well. And they don't have any data on something coming down in Keksberg either, from what we know, as far as we know. So it's hard to imagine. I don't think NASA has some kind of conspiracy to lie to us. You know, I don't think, you know. So anyway, the tree thing is very similar in that it's just an expert going out and looking at the data.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you have to do. And in both cases, the experts were able to determine, first of all, that it wasn't Soviet, but the tree thing was so interesting because we actually have physical evidence that something came down at that time, even though the Air Force is telling us that nothing came down. So,
yeah, they said that with a straight face, too.
So I've never actually seen their faces. I'd like to see the faces of the people.
Yeah, well, maybe you could detect something. You're a good reporter. We got to rely on body language and everything else.
Exactly. And in fact, we've been discussing that one of our next steps may be to take some of this data to the Air Force and ask them to respond.
And I would think the difficulty of that, it would be to find the proper authority in the Air Force.
To find somebody that even knows anything about something that occurred 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, they did put something on a flatbed truck. It did leave. It must be somewhere.
That's my position. I agree with you. But again, we don't have any proof of that, at least official proof. And we're going to keep demanding it and keep pressuring the government to provide answers for us.
So you've been pretty busy with Kecksburg still, yeah, because of the anniversary.
Absolutely. We're doing a lot of preparations, and we're going to be doing lectures and talks and, you know, trying to get people to come, et cetera.
Have you written a book?
Not on this. I think Stan Gordon is possibly working on one.
Yeah, he's running one on Bigfoot. I know that.
And I know he wants to do one on this case. Maybe we'll end up collaborating on something.
Well, that'd be interesting.
The other interesting development that's new is that I was able to locate some of the original Air Force personnel who searched for the object. You remember the Project Blue Book statement that a three-man team went out and searched for the object? Sort of a famous...
Mm-hmm.
From Project Blue Book, a three-man team was sent to search for an object.
And then who were these other people?
Able to locate some of these three.
Oh, great.
And this, I was able to do that actually through this private investigator who was able to find some of these.
Uh-huh.
And what was very interesting was, first of all, we only found one who actually says he went out to search for the object. And what's very interesting about that, he's a lieutenant, and he said that he went out to search and he didn't find anything, which is what we would have expected him to say because that's what Blue Book says. But the interesting point is he also said that they didn't observe any Army presence in the area, no excess civilian activity, which, we, you know, there were hundreds of people.
Right. It was all over the radio and television.
Exactly. All over the radio and television.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't see any activity of any unusual activity, no roadblocks, no police officers, no Army members, no spotlights, which we know were shining down in the woods,
uh-huh.
nothing unusual. So it just seems when you hear that, you know, it seemed impossible to me that he could have searched the area and not been aware of that kind of activity. And there seems like there's two possibilities. One, he went to the wrong place, or two, he's not telling the truth. I don't know what it is, but it's possible. We have a theory, and it's only a theory, that possibly some of these people were taken to the wrong location. And indeed, they didn't find anything because they weren't in the right place. It's, you know, we don't know what happened. But
well, they should have turned on their radio in their car while they were going out there.
Well, exactly. It's that simple, isn't it? It's that simple. It's such a mystery because... you know, as I mentioned, I interviewed three or four of these people, and there were lots of contradictions, too, between what they told me.
So, you know, if you're a defense lawyer, you would draw the conclusion that somebody's lying.
You don't know what to make of this. You know, it's a long time ago. Maybe they don't remember things accurately, but there were some that were, you know, strong enough that things that should have been remembered and that just don't make sense.
Yeah, at least they didn't get together and... put a story together. They,
I think you would, or that maybe everybody has terrible memories. I don't know. They're all getting Alzheimer's. I don't know, but you're right. It's, and you know, there's only so far that we can go. But what's interesting is that just to have on record that there are these contradictions. You know, that's more intriguing to me than if everybody had said the same thing.
Well, reading between the lines, is there anything there between all of these people that leads you to believe that, A, they were in the wrong place, or they actually saw something and they're covering it up?
It's just so hard to know.
Yeah.
All I know is what they've told me, when you know, which is they didn't. This one guy, he didn't see anything unusual. And they searched for, they took some flashlights into the woods and searched for a few hours and went home. But, you know, I don't know, there's nothing I can read into that except to sort of go over all the possible explanations for it.
Yeah, I understand. Well, what's your hunch about Kecksburg? Will we ever find out?
Well, you know, I think it's, I'm hopeful that we will, but I also think it's very possible that we will never find out exactly what it was. If they've held on to information this tightly for this long... whether they will ever tell us, I have no idea. I think it could go either way. But I also believe that even if we don't find out what the object was, the case has been extremely worthwhile. The investigation has been worthwhile because it's highlighted so many issues that need to be addressed, one of them being how difficult it is for citizens of this country to get information that is due them under the Freedom of Information Act.
And I know you're deeply involved in that, and it's very upsetting to me as well that they get away with this over and over.
Exactly, and you know, most citizens cannot afford to hire a law firm. The only reason we've been able to go to court is because we have the resources from the Sci-Fi Channel to hire a law firm. But what's the average person supposed to do? So I'm very pleased that regardless of whether we solve the case or not, that we've been able to draw attention to the issues around the Freedom of Information Act. We've also drawn attention to the UFO question in general, that it's a valid question and, you know, that this is a valid case, it's worthy of investigation. So I look at the whole effort as a success, even if we don't find out what the object was. And there's still a lot more work to do. It's not over yet. You know, we still have to go further with the Army and the Air Force in our demands, and it may have to end up filing a lawsuit against them as well.
Well, we'll keep checking with you, Leslie, to find out future developments.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your interest, Jerry, very much, and appreciate people listening into this interview.
Oh, it's great. It's always a good little interview when I get a chance to talk to you. I always enjoy the session.
Well, feel free to call anytime.
I will. And so how do you like New York?
New York is intense. A lot going on here. It's exciting. You know, it's a mixed bag, but I'm from New York. I grew up here. Lots of family here, and I feel very at home in New York.
Well, good. We'll be talking to you again soon.
Okay, Jerry. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to thank Leslie Kane, and before Leslie, of course, Stan Gordon. A great show about Kecksburg. What do you think happened? Hey, our show time is up. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. Larry Dickin is our executive producer, and today's show was edited by James Ward. Until next time, cheers.